So the reading this evening is Psalm 32, which can be found on page 395 of the Church Bible. Blessed is he whose transgressions are forgiven, whose sins are covered. Blessed is the man whose sin the Lord does not count against him, and in whose spirit is no deceit. When I kept quiet, my bones wasted away through my groaning all day long. For day and night your hand was heavy upon me, your strength was sapped, as in the heat of summer. Then I acknowledged my sin to you, and did not cover up my iniquity. I said, I will confess my transgressions to the Lord, and you forgave the guilt of my sin. Therefore, let everyone who is godly pray to you while you may be found. Surely when the mighty waters rise, they will not reach me. You are my hiding place. You will protect me from trouble and surround me with songs of deliverance. I will instruct you and teach you in the way you should go. I will counsel you and watch over you. Do not be like the horse or the mule, which have no understanding, but must be controlled by the bit and bridle, or they will not come to you. Many are the woes of the wicked, but the Lord's unfailing love surrounds the man who trusts in him. Rejoice in the Lord and be glad, you righteous. Sing, all you who are upright in heart. Amen.
Well, can I start by asking you a question this evening? What makes you happy? What makes you happy? What brings a smile to your face? I guess what we were thinking about a little bit this morning, you can't help but grab the Olympics on the TV, can you? And when the UK get another medal, it's, yes, they've done it again. We've got another one. It's been great to see us slowly climbing the medal table over the last few days, hasn't it? That's certainly brought a smile to my face. I guess, apart the Olympics aside, in a room this size, just with this amount of people in it, there'd be varied answers to that question, and what necessarily might make you smile won't necessarily make me smile, and kind of things like that, I guess. Well, some research was carried out around the world, and the results of that research were collated by an organization called World Happiness Database. This is totally legitimate. You can put that into Google and you'll find this later. They're based in Rotterdam, and the report of the research was reported by the BBC back in July of 2013. And here are some conclusions to the research. You're more likely to be happier if you're at least one of these five things. Okay, here we go. One, you're in a long-term relationship. Two, you're actively engaged in politics. I thought I might make you laugh. Three, you're active at work and active in free time. Four, you go out for dinner. Well, I suppose we can all relate to that, can't we? And five, you have close relationships. Apparently, the happiest place to live in the world is Costa Rica, according to the research. Sorry to say, the UK didn't even come in the top 10. It's rather sad, isn't it? But is the research right? Well, David, in this psalm, helps us to see that we don't need to do any of those things, thankfully, or go and live in Costa Rica, as nice as that might be. Because David, in this psalm, shows us where deep, lasting joy of heart comes from. Look with me at Psalm 32. Because Psalm 32, as you can see on the screen, is about knowing the joy of forgiven sin. Knowing the joy of forgiven sin. Because that makes David happy. David rejoices. David finds real, internal, heartfelt gladness. Joy in his heart of knowing his sin has been forgiven by God. Psalm is bracketed by David in that way. Just have a look at verse 1. Blessed, happy is he whose transgressions are forgiven, whose sins are covered. Again, the end of the psalm, verse 11. Rejoice in the Lord and be glad. Be joyful, you righteous. Sing, all you who are upright in heart. And David shows us in this psalm four reasons that lead you, if you're a Christian this evening, as it leads me, to find that same joy, that gladness in our hearts, deep, lasting happiness, in the Christian life for the forgiveness of our sin through Jesus. So we'll see all four reasons are fulfilled in Jesus for us this evening. Well, what are those four reasons? Let's get into the psalm and have a look at them. Firstly, Jesus forgives our sin. Have a look at verse 1 again. Blessed is he whose transgressions are forgiven, whose sins are covered. Blessed is the man whose sin the Lord does not count against him, and in whose spirit is no deceit. See, there's absolutely no doubt about it from David. He knows that God, that Yahweh, the covenant-making and covenant-keeping God, whom he serves, has forgiven him of his sin. David's got full assurance of that. There's no room for doubt in his words here, no room at all. Now, I don't know if they do it to you, but they certainly do it to me. It's usually door-to-door salesmen. As soon as they start speaking, I just simply doubt every single word that they say, from the very first word to the very last word. It does help when you're in rented accommodation because you've just got the liner. It's rented, sorry, close the door, and they're gone. But for the persistent ones who don't care and really want to sell you what it is that they've got, I just don't believe what they're saying. I doubt what they say very quickly. You see, I hear the words, but my mind is just switches off. My mind says to me, don't believe a word of it, Adam. It sounds too good to be true. But for David, that's simply not the case. He knows his sin is forgiven. He's in full assurance of that. The word forgiven also comes from a word meaning to take away. The idea is that David knows he's blessed, he's happy at the knowledge that his sin has been taken away from him. For those of us with a mortgage this evening, we can tap into David's feelings here. Imagine you have a distant relative, one that you've not really had much contact with, and they've sadly passed away, but they've left you a rather large portion of their inheritance, enough to completely clear your mortgage for you. And so that's what you use it for. You pay off your mortgage in full. In that sense, your mortgage has been taken away from you. You no longer have any mortgage debt. It would be great, wouldn't it? David's happy to know his sin has been taken away from him. And David continues in his assurance. He knows his sin has been covered, the end of verse 1. And this covering, well, it's like digging a hole into the ground of a field. See, David knows that his sin has been taken away from him, and he knows his sin, as it were, has been thrown into the hole. And then this hole has been filled back in and completely covered over and left flat. No one would be able to tell that there was a hole there at all. All his sin has been covered, not swept under the rug or hidden behind a cupboard. David knows his sin has been covered. And furthermore, David knows that God doesn't count his sin against him. In verse 2, his assurance continues because following his forgiveness and covering of his sin, David stands without any debt before God. Blessed is the verse 2, blessed is the man whose sin the Lord does not count against him. David knows that God doesn't hold up, as it were, David's book of debt, a book with a list after list of all of David's sins. Sins that would have put David in a massive debt towards God, a debt that he could never repay. He knows he has no debt before God. David's a blessed man, a happy man, because his sin has been forgiven. It's been taken away from him. His sin has been covered, never to be seen again. And God isn't counting David's sin against him. David also wrote these words in Psalm 103. Let me just read this one verse for us from Psalm 103, verse 12. Psalm 103, verse 12. As far as the east is from the west, so far has he removed our transgressions from us. That's David's assurance. There's no room for uncertainty in his words. He's fully assured his sin has completely and fully been removed. I also think that part of David's happiness and assurance lies in his experience of battling with sin. Have a look with me at verse 3. David writes, when I kept silent, my bones wasted away through my groaning all day long. Can you feel David's words here? He's expressing his physical torment of holding on to sin and the guilt that it brings. And sin does that. Sin does bear on us. It can be like a physical weight that we carry around, because sin produces guilt, and it's guilt that produces the weight. But also sin brings God's judgment. David felt God's judgment on him because of his sin. David says in verse 4, "For day and night your hand was heavy upon me. My strength was sapped as in the heat of summer." So what did David do in his battle with sin? What's David's experience? Well, David continues, verse 5, "Then I acknowledged my sin to you and did not cover up my iniquity. I said, I will confess my transgressions to the Lord, and you forgave the guilt of my sin." What did David do? He confessed his sin to God. And please note the little play on words here. Did you notice what David said he didn't do in the second line of verse 5? "Did not cover up my iniquity." What did David say in verse 1? "Blessed is the person whose sins are covered." David knows that when he tried to cover his sin for himself, it led to that physical trouble of carrying the weight of the guilt of his sin and of feeling God's judgment upon him. David knew he couldn't cover his sin for himself. He couldn't deal with his own sin. It caused him nothing but trouble and heartache. Instead, he called out to God for God to cover his sin. He's relying on God to do what only God could do for him: remove his sin from him. And that brings David great joy. And I just want to take a sidestep, just very briefly, for a couple of minutes here, because we need to note the two presuppositions here. Because firstly, this presupposes that David knew that his sin was an offence against God. That's why he goes to God to forgive him for his sin. Secondly, it also presupposes that David knew he was guilty of sin in the first place. And I flag that up because generally people today don't see themselves as guilty of sin before God. We were helping out on a Christian camp just a week ago. I did a Bible talk as part of that camp through the week, and I showed a little video clip with various people answering this question. It was from YouTube. The question was this: what makes a good person? There was various answers to that question. At least two of the people in answering that question said that we're inherently good people on that video clip. We are inherently good. That's what they said. And that may be you this evening. You may think that you're inherently good. But God, through the Bible, teaches us that we're not inherently good people. Now, we're capable of doing good things, depending on how you define good, which is another problem in our society today. But in and of ourselves, we're not good. We're sinful. Our hearts are corrupt. God has given us good boundaries to live by, but we alter, we change, we amend, and we move those boundaries to suit ourselves. So God has said that we shouldn't lie, just one example. But we make that boundary flexible to suit us. We create big lies and little lies. Little lies are okay because they don't really hurt anybody. Well, big lies, well, they're not okay because they're a little bit more serious and we could cause a bit of damage with those ones. But the obvious problem is that they're both lies, whether little or big. Moving and adjusting the boundaries that God has set for us is what the Bible calls sin. So what can the Christian do today? Well, there's lots of things that the Christian can do. But if we are a Christian here this evening, I think we need to at least hold on to these two things. Firstly, God is holy. He is not like us. He is separate from us, because he is inherently good. And secondly, God is a just judge. He will judge everyone by his justice for how they've lived their lives. Those two things will help you, as they help me, remember your own sin and my own sin before God. But also, perhaps, they may possibly create opportunities to talk to others about sin in a world that doesn't even acknowledge it. Well, back in Psalm 32, David's aware of his sinful heart and the offence that it brings to God. He goes to God for forgiveness. He knows only God can cover his sin and remove the weight of guilt from him. And this brings joy, gladness to David's heart. He considers his life to be a blessed life. And like David, you, as I, if we're a Christian this evening, or can have if we're not a Christian this evening, full assurance that our sin has been forgiven. It has been covered. God doesn't hold our sin against us like a debt we can't repay. We can come to Jesus and confess our sin and know we're forgiven. Don't try and cover up your sin for yourself. See, if you're feeling the burden, perhaps feeling the weight that guilt produces, maybe you're trying to carry your own sin for yourself, deal with it by your own means. But you can't deal with it. You need Jesus. Hebrews chapter 9, verse 26 says this again. Let me just read that verse for us. It's Hebrews chapter 9, verse 26. But now he, Jesus, has appeared once for all at the end of the ages to do away with sin by the sacrifice of himself. See, Jesus took all my sin and your sin upon himself on the cross. It has all been paid for by him. Taken from me, taken from you, and placed on Jesus. Jesus forgives our sin. Secondly, Jesus is our refuge from sin. Have a look at verse 6. Therefore, let everyone who is godly pray to you while you may be found. Surely when the mighty waters rise, they will not reach him. You are my hiding place. You will protect me from trouble and surround me with songs of deliverance. And here David wants others to experience this same deep, lasting happiness of heart, this same joy, because he opens this psalm up to others to follow him in going to God to be forgiven of their sin and find their refuge in him. One commentary I read suggested that a maskil, which this psalm is, could be used as a form of liturgy by God's people. I think these verses help us to see that. So as God's people gathered corporately at the temple, they would have said this psalm aloud together, calling each other to pray to God and to seek him as their only refuge, their only safe place from the trouble of their sin. David said in verse 6, surely when the mighty waters rise, when trouble comes, they will not reach him. You are my hiding place. Talking to God, you are my hiding place. You will protect me from trouble. And when sin attacks, which it will do, its attack will be useless against those who seek God, against those who find their refuge in him. One of sin's attacks and the problems that sin causes in the Christian's life is that it will try and make you and me believe lies. One of those lies says, our sin tells us that we can't go to God with our sin for it to be dealt with. We can't seek him. We can't find our refuge in him. Our sin perhaps tells us that he will never forgive us. Our sin tells us, well, it's just too bad. That your sin might tell you that you're a failure because you've sinned again, you've done it again. Or that you're not really a very good Christian, are you? Perhaps sin tells you that, well, God's not going to be pleased with you after all that, after what you've said, after what you've done. Maybe sin says that God's patience, well, it's going to run out this time. Maybe sin says that God won't love you because, well, you've offended him again. But those are lies that we might be tempted to believe. Let me read again some words from the same Psalm of David, 103. Let me just read verses 8 to 10. Psalm 103, verses 8 to 10. The Lord is compassionate and gracious, slow to anger, abounding in love. He will not always accuse, nor will he harbor his anger forever. He does not treat us as our sins deserve, or repay us according to our iniquities. Tremendous words, aren't they? That is the character of God. Do they encourage you this evening? Do they comfort you? Do they draw you nearer to God? Because our sin, well, it wants to push us away from God. But as for David, so for the Christian, we can go to Jesus with our sin because he is our refuge from its troubles and attacks. I love the parable of the prodigal son in Luke 15 because it captures in story form the character of God as we've read from Psalm 103. Very briefly, it goes like this. I'm sure some of you know it well. But one of the sons in that parable, there's a father and two sons. One of the sons takes his inheritance from his father before his father dies, but basically wishing his father was dead, treating his father with complete contempt. And the son, well, he leaves home and he wastes all of his inheritance money on wild living and partying. Well, eventually the money dries up and the son finds himself working on a pig farm. He's hit kind of rough times, almost rock bottom. So desperate is this son's situation that he's tempted to eat the pig's food. And by any standard or culture or society, that's a pretty low place to be in, isn't it? Well, the son at that rock bottom place comes to his senses and he's realized that he's sinned against God and against his father. So he resolves himself to return home and confess his sin to his father and ask his father to take him back as a slave, because he knows that he's not worthy to be called a son because of the way that he's treated his father. And so he sets off for home. But his father is looking for him. His father sees him coming from a distance, and his father races out to meet him and greet him and accept him and love him and bring him back into the family and treat him as a son. Such is the depth of the father's love for his son. And so Jesus teaches us that the depth of God's love for those who turn to him and confess their sin. Because of Jesus, we go to him with our sin, find that he still loves us, still accepts us, treats us in a way that we don't deserve to be treated, because his love for us is deep enough and wide enough. Paul wrote in his letter to the church at Rome these words. Again, let me just read them from Romans chapter 8, verse 1. Romans chapter 8, verse 1. There is now no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. Jesus is our refuge from sin. Well, the third reason for having joy at forgiven sin from Psalm 32 is that Jesus directs our lives away from sin. Verse 8, I will instruct you and teach you in the way you should go. I will counsel you and watch over you. Do not be like the horse or the mule, which have no understanding, but must be controlled by bit and bridle, or they will not come to you. And I've put it under that heading, Jesus directs our lives away from sin, because I think that's the context of the whole psalm. Quite interestingly, the person speaking changes here in these verses. It's no longer David speaking, but God speaking to David. And yes, these verses could be taken more generally to mean that God will direct you through life as you live for him. And I think that would be right. But why would God suddenly start talking generally when the whole psalm is addressing the joy of forgiven sin? I think it also makes sense that God will lead and direct those who live for him in ways that are contrary to sin. Remember that David's life is blessed. He has joy, gladness in his heart because his sin has been forgiven and it's not counted against him. He's blessed because God is his refuge from sin's attacks and troubles. And he's blessed. He has a gladness in his heart because God will direct his life in God's ways. And God's ways are totally incompatible with sin's ways. Look with me at what David says about those who live for sin. The first line of verse 10. Many are the woes of the wicked. It's so true, isn't it? I'm not suggesting that the Christian never has any problems. Far from it. But I'm suggesting that those who live for themselves or for anything other than Jesus never really have lasting joy or gladness in their hearts. Why do I say that? Well, because people are never satisfied with what they've got. People always want more. This is what the man who created the computer game Minecraft said. He sold the game to Microsoft. He made rather a lot of money out of it, just over £2 billion, I think. His name is Marcus Pearson, and he said this. These are his words that he made in a tweet, I think, a couple of years ago. This is what he said. Hanging out in Ibiza with a bunch of friends and partying with famous people. Able to do whatever I want. And I've never felt more isolated. Enough money to do whatever he likes in this world. And he's not satisfied. There's an emptiness in his life. See, many people would want the money he's got, wouldn't they? Many people live, work and breathe for the money he's got, even to have half of what he's got. And yet what's Marcus's woe, as Psalm 32 would call it? Isolation, loneliness. He's not happy. He hasn't got joy in his heart because money can't buy lasting joy. But so many people think that money will buy them happiness, which is why they want more of it. But that's living for an idol. Money is an idol in many people's hearts, and all it does is let people down. Money as an idol doesn't really buy lasting joy and happiness, because money as an idol doesn't satisfy. But those who live for Jesus do find satisfaction, and so are able to find lasting joy and happiness, because their satisfaction is in Jesus. Jesus wants those who trust in him to live for him, to obey his teaching. And those who put Jesus first in their hearts and lives can and do feel a real deep lasting joy and gladness of heart that does last, because Jesus does fully satisfy. He doesn't leave our hearts feeling empty. If anyone's into all-you-can-eat buffets, you'll know what I mean. They're the kind that offer all-you-can-eat for £10 or something similar. If you're like me, you want to get your money's worth out of that deal, don't you? So you make several trips, ensuring that you've had your money's worth with several platefuls of food, even a doggy bag if you can get away with it to take some home. You won't be leaving with an empty stomach. Jesus directs our lives in his ways, which brings joy to our hearts because he fully satisfies our hearts. All we need is in him. Jesus directs our lives away from sin because living for sin doesn't bring true happiness and joy to the heart, because sin never can and never will fully satisfy. It always leaves people wanting more and chasing after other things. Christian doesn't escape hardship and trials, I'm not saying that. But even in those hardships and trials, through those hardships and trials, the Christian can experience joy in their heart because of Jesus. That's something that those who don't trust in Jesus can never experience. Jesus directs our lives away from sin. Fourthly, Jesus has made us righteous. Verse 11, rejoice in the Lord and be glad, you righteous. Sing, all you who are upright in heart. And we finish where we started in verse 1. David's heart is full of joy because he knows his sin is forgiven. He calls those who recite this psalm with him to rejoice in God, in Yahweh, that covenant-making and keeping God who David serves. But as we finish, it's our status that we, like David, can find deep lasting joy and gladness of heart in. Because that status is in being righteous. And as David also says at the end of the verse 11, upright in heart. See, with sin forgiven, sin covered, and not counted against us, or against David, with David being directed to live in God's ways, it's almost the summary of all of that. That David knows he stands before God as righteous, as one without sin. That's David's perspective on himself, because he knows that that's God's perspective on him. And that perspective too brings joy to his heart. This too makes David happy. See, if you wear glasses, you know exactly what I mean. I appreciate there are many types of lenses, but say without glasses, your vision is a little blurry. That blurriness distorts how you see the world, doesn't it? You can't quite make out what's on the TV screen or all the words on the page of a book or a newspaper that you might be reading. You wouldn't dare drive your car. Well, you might, but I wouldn't recommend it. You wouldn't dare drive your car without wearing your glasses in case you cause a crash. But with your glasses on, the world almost changes. You can make things out clearly. You can enjoy watching the Olympics and enjoy the newspaper or the book that you're reading. You can get into the car and know when you need to stop or let another car go. And David has a right perspective on his status before God, because he's looking at himself as he knows the way in which God looks at him. He puts the glasses on, as it were. And the same is true for the Christian this evening. Because if you're a Christian, then you, as I, need to have that same perspective on ourselves as David had on himself and our status before God. And because of Jesus, God looks upon us as righteous. Because of Jesus, God doesn't look at us and see our crooked, corrupt hearts with sin. He sees Jesus' perfection instead. Because in Jesus, the Christian is also upright in heart. And that's only possible because of the cross. Because as Jesus takes our sin from us and places it on himself, he also takes his perfect obedience to God from himself and gives it to us. And so God looks at those trusting in Jesus and sees Jesus' perfect obedience, an obedience that makes us righteous before God. God doesn't look upon our hearts and feel disgust at our sin. Perhaps you feel that sometimes, wrestle with that. God doesn't look at the Christian and make note of the ugliness of their hearts. Maybe you do that. But that's like taking the glasses off. You've got a blurred vision of yourself. You, as I, need to understand that we need to keep the glasses on, as it were, see ourselves in the same way that God sees us. And that's as righteous because of Jesus. Well, I started with the question, what makes you happy? Can I encourage you this week, as I encourage myself, to remember these four reasons for finding deep, lasting joy in your heart and my heart at forgiven sin? Because Jesus forgives your sin. Jesus is your only refuge from sin. Jesus directs your life away from sin. Jesus has made you righteous. And as we do that, as I do that, as you do that, as you fix your thoughts on Jesus and what he's done for you by going to the cross and rising again, then the Holy Spirit will fill us with a joy, because joy, well, it is a fruit of the Spirit. The Spirit will create a deep, lasting joy in your heart. Feelings are strange things, aren't they? They go up and down and they change so quickly. But deep, lasting joy of heart is possible because it's produced by the Holy Spirit. Look only to Jesus and trust in the Spirit to work in your heart, which he'll do.